Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
In my last podcast, we talked about ways to separate how data is stored in memory from how it is packaged when in transit. We discussed EDI, and I closed by saying that in the 1960s, at about the same time that the foundation of EDI was being laid, with the first electronic communications between companies, a different technology was being developed that would turn out, 40 years later, to be far more influential. This is the technology of markup languages. Any printed document has two aspects. One is the actual content of the document, structured into paragraphs and maybe also into sections and chapters. The other aspect is the document's presentation, how the words are actually laid out on the page. In some special classes of documents, content and presentation are interwoven, and the beauty and impact of the document comes from the way they fit together. Many poets use spacing and indentation expressively. In handwritten scrolls of the Torah, certain passages, such as the Song of the Sea, are laid out with blocks of text, one on top of another in the style of a brick wall. Important pronouncements, the Magna Carta, the American Declaration of Independence, for example, are almost always on a single large sheet. You can't imagine such a document written in a small notebook. And more prosaically, advertisements often rely as much on the appearance of words as on their meaning. At the other extreme, there are documents whose meaning is conveyed entirely by the words. Code is a good example of this. The meaning of a program is independent of how it's laid out, and it makes no difference to how the program executes if you change the spacing of words or lines. If you want the program to be more readable, which is a good idea, you can follow some simple rules for layout, or you can run the code through a pretty printer. The point is, you don't need to think about it. The standard layout is defined by the content, and therefore adds nothing to it. It's true that there are some languages that have actually given meaning to the layout. In Python, for example, the meaning of a line of code can change depending on its level of indentation. This turns out to be a horrible idea, in large part because it's so easy to confuse tabs and spaces, so that the indentation you see visually as a human reader doesn't match what the interpreter sees when it runs the program. Between these two extremes lie most documents. Presentation does matter, but to a large extent it's independent of the content. Preparing the content and designing the presentation are often two different jobs. A novelist, for example, writes the text of the book, and a typographer selects the typefaces and does the page design. It's important to have a separation of concerns between content, on the one hand, and presentation, on the other, because otherwise they can't be changed independently of one another. The writer, for example, should be able to edit the content of the novel, while the designer works independently on the layout. Nowadays, furthermore, documents are often produced for a variety of media. You might have a PDF version of the novel for downloading and printing, a large print version for people with poor eyesight, and so on. So separating content and presentation is even more important. How is this separation of concerns achieved? The basic idea, common to all schemes, is to split the document into two parts. One part has only the content, and uses special predefined names for the common structural components. The other part, often called a style sheet, has a list of formatting rules associated with each of the names of these structural components. For example, the structural components may be things like chapter titles, section headings, quotations, and so on. Then if some text is marked as a chapter title, to format it, we just look up the formatting rule for chapter titles in the style sheet. This idea was first used in computer systems for the Bravo text editor at Xerox PARC. Charles Simony took the idea to Microsoft, where it became part of Word, and from there it became part of just about every text preparation program on Earth. Funnily enough, most users of Word don't even know about this facility, and they use Word as a typewriter, formatting segments of text manually. But if you want to write anything longer than a page or two, it's much more convenient to use a style sheet. That way you can, for example, change the font size on all your section headings in one fell swoop. Typographic layout programs, like Adobe InDesign, let you import text from Word but ignore the Word style sheet, and use instead one defined in InDesign. This is wonderful because it means that a book designer can first structure the book by setting the styles of paragraphs, for example, saying that this paragraph is a heading and this paragraph is a quotation, and can then format it later by adjusting the style sheet. The word approach has two limitations. First of all, the language in which the document structure is expressed is proprietary and complicated. So there's limited choice of authoring tools, and you have to worry about different versions and inevitable bugs in the tools that read and write the documents. Second, this approach views a document as a sequence of paragraphs. There's no hierarchical structuring. This means that the approach doesn't work so well for more complex technical documents. In the 1960s, at around the same time that EDI was being born, a group of engineers at IBM invented the first markup language. They called it GML for Generalized Markup Language, or for their surnames, Goldfarb, Mosher, and Lorry. This language allowed you to structure a document as a tree. You could define a list, for example, containing a sequence of items, and each of these items could itself be a list. IBM made a product based on GML called the Document Composition Facility, DCF, but it took another 30 years for the idea to really take off. In 1986, an international standard was developed for markup languages called SGML, the Standard Generalized Markup Language, and this then formed the basis for Tim Berners-Lee's HTML, the first language of the World Wide Web. The latest incarnation of markup languages is HTML5, which is currently under development. HTML didn't separate content and presentation very rigorously, and in the early days, HTML documents contained their own style sheets. Worse, HTML encouraged explicit formatting within the body of the document, with tags like font that let you choose the typeface. HTML5 gets rid of that and has a cleaner separation. Nowadays, even in predecessors of HTML5, presentation is defined in a language called cascading style sheets, or CSS, in separate files. This separation of concerns makes it easier for a web designer to give a consistent appearance to all the pages in a website, since by factoring out the typeface and the layout and so on in the style sheet, you can change them everywhere on the site just by changing the definition in one file. SGML was a pretty complicated language. Its definition had over 500 pages. HTML is pretty complicated too. So in the late 1990s, an effort was launched at the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3C, to find a simpler syntax. The result was XML, the Extensible Markup Language. XML has an extremely uniform structure. A document is basically a block defined by an opening and closing tag that can contain other blocks. This regularity allowed XML to be defined in only 26 pages. XML itself doesn't specify what the tags are and how a document is structured. To do that, you define what's called an XML schema, written in XML itself. This allows HTML to be defined as an XML language. Well, not quite. HTML was a bit too loose for that, so a variant called XHTML was defined. Unfortunately, though, XHTML hasn't taken off, in part because Microsoft decided not to support it in Internet Explorer. But XML has been very successful in another area, web services. And this will take us full circle back to EDI. You may remember that in my last podcast, we talked about separating the representation of data in memory from its representation in transit, and the need for a separate format for sending and receiving data. We talked about binary formats such as CORBA and DCOM, and the text-based format of EDI. With the success of the web, the question arose, why not just send data around as documents? The obvious language to do this in was XML, since it's simpler and easier to parse than HTML. And the presentation aspect isn't relevant. The first protocol like this was called XML-RPC, which stands for XML Remote Procedure Call. The idea was just to call procedures by sending the data as an XML document, using HTTP as the transport protocol. The procedure could then send a response as another XML document. XML-RPC became SOAP, which originally stood for Simple Object Access Protocol. SOAP messages are more verbose than EDI messages because of the more systematic syntax, but they're human readable. They're also longer, and very much longer than binary messages in CORBA or DCOM, which can be problematic if throughput is an issue. Even though XML is simple compared to ETI, it's still more complicated than most applications need for calling services. When you call a service to get the weather or book a ticket, for example, viewing the request as a document is overkill. It's really just a collection of name-value bindings. To request the weather, for example, a service just might require a zip code, a date, and some preference flags. For this reason, many programmers are now using a simpler format called JSON, which stands for JavaScript Object Notation. JSON was originally designed for JavaScript, hence the name, but there are parsers for most programming languages. That brings us to the end of a rather long discussion of separating the concerns about how data is represented in memory versus data in transit. We've discussed a rather bewildering variety of technologies, but I hope you can see that there are only a few underlying ideas, and the ideas are pretty straightforward. Here's a tip for how to deepen your understanding of these technologies. Take two of the technologies at random and compare them. Rather than just noting all the differences, see if instead you can find commonalities that they share. Take CORBA and SOAP, for example. A key element of CORBA is the Interface Definition Language, or IDL, used to define the structure of the messages in a client-independent way. So you might ask yourself, is there an IDL for SOAP? The answer, it turns out, is yes, and it's called WSDL, or the Web Services Description Language. So technology marches on, but the same ideas resurface again and again.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.